How much money do you lose every time you miss a customer call? With a Buzz CRM, you never have to worry about that again. Their system automatically texts missed calls and engages leads instantly using conversational AI. It turns your missed opportunities into booked appointments automatically. It's a complete game changer for local businesses. Secure your access today for a massive discount at thebuzzcrm.com. That's thebuzzcrm.com.
My friends, once again, I am Vivian McPeak, and this is Hemp Present. If you have feedback or would like to suggest a guest or topic for Hemp Present, you should know it by now. Shoot me an email at hemppresent@gmail.com. Jason Dunlap is a photographer and filmmaker based in Los Angeles, where he runs a studio producing cannabis-focused content, documentaries, and unscripted material in the historic Wiltern. With a career spanning fashion, music, and art industries, Jason has been documenting the cannabis space since 2003, capturing the work and stories of pioneers like Eddie Lepp, Jack Herer, Dennis Perone, Lynette Shaw, and many more. His work blends cultural insight with visual storytelling, preserving the history and evolution of cannabis for new generation. Hey, Jason, how you doing, my brother?
I'm great, man. It's great to see you again.
Absolutely. God, you know, I mean, Jack Herer, Dennis Perone, Lynette Shaw, Eddie Lepp, all, you know, luminaries in the cannabis movement, all good friends. That's a great list. Before we get to all of that, can you just begin by describing your studio and the area of L.A. that it's in?
Yeah, totally. I'm in the Wiltern. I don't know if you know the Wiltern Theater, but it's a famous theater here. It's a beautiful Art Deco style theater. So we're right in Koreatown here. We have a great little studio, and basically, well, in a nutshell, I have about 700 hours of footage of the Eddie and Linda story that I've been telling, I've been filming. And so we're basically just consolidating all of that and putting that into a documentary, at least 120 minutes. And we're doing that all out of the Wiltern. And while I'm doing that, I'm in pre-production for a couple of podcasts. One, for example, called The Lynette Shaw Show, where it'll be Lynette interviewing all the 215 people, all the old vanguard out of San Francisco, for lack of better terms. So that's our main focus now, is putting out historical things to really teach people, you know, what happened and how it happened.
Yeah, I was born and raised in L.A. Much of my childhood, so I do know the Wiltern.
What part of L.A.?
Wiltshire, Vermont area, basically, in North Hollywood.
That's right down. Yeah, I know that whole area.
Yeah, I mean, I was literally like a half a block from the Ambassador Hotel. Even when Robert Kennedy was shot, we heard the sirens is how close we were.
That's crazy.
I got some wild stories on that, but maybe I'll do a podcast on it. You know, Jason, I've seen your work, and it's very compelling and really well constructed. And you know, as we said, it features some of the most high profile activists in the hemp and medical cannabis movements. Can you talk about Jack Herer, widely seen as the godfather of the modern industrial hemp movement, and the late medical cannabis activist Eddie Lepp? They're both have departed us, unfortunately. And really your immersion into the lives of the subjects of your documentary work. What was that like with both of them?
Well, I mean, it's an adventure, to say the least. You know, when the way we filmed was, we moved in, like in 2003, I went out and I met Eddie. I knew a little bit about the cannabis industry, but not a lot. I read an Ed Rosenthal book that I got a lot of information from. But, you know, I never really read High Times or anything like that. And so I got out, I met Eddie, I filmed a harvest. I went back to New York. I showed it around to some people, and nobody was really interested. You know, cannabis was such a off topic at the time. But it was at the beginning of the digital revolution, so the idea of having a small camera and filming was doable. So I basically, Eddie said, well, why don't you just move on? So I moved out in 2004, and right before Eddie planted his infamous field, and we started filming. And through that process, I was able to meet Jack Herer, Dennis Perone, Lynette, and all these people. And it was amazing. I knew why I felt marijuana should be legal. And then I meet someone like Eddie, and it's a whole different life. It's a whole different thing. It's a lifestyle for these people. And I never really realized that till I got there. So like, everything is cannabis. Everything is helping people. Everything is 215. And then Jack comes along. I meet Jack for Eddie's birthday, would be that, you know, May, June. We had a party for Eddie. And that was stellar, man. It was like meeting Jack was amazing. I met Jack pre-stroke. For those who don't know, there was Jack before he had a stroke. And that's the Jack that wrote The Emperor Wears No Clothes. And then Jack, unfortunately, had a stroke and he suffered through that. And I met Jack after that. And it was amazing to see everything he went through, and he was at it morning, noon, and night. Like, I would help Jack go sell some of his books in San Francisco, and we'd leave Lake County at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and we'd get back to Lake County at like 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. There's just no stopping that man. And that's what I think I picked up the most from Jack and Eddie specifically, is just, you got to do it, you know, and that's how they did it. And so, so yeah, man, I don't know if that answered your question or not, but you know.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that Jack was one of the most driven people I've ever met. I mean, yes. he had a mono focus. I met him in 1990. I think his stroke was in 2010, if I remember correctly.
He had a stroke in like 2003, I think, right before I met him too. Then he had stroke in 2010.
Right. Anybody else would have been done on the speaking circuit, you know, if they had a stroke and they had trouble talking. But Jack would not stop. He literally learned to talk again, touring and speaking. I mean, he's just amazing.
Yeah.
Jason, you kind of mentioned we live in the age of digital influencers, and now everyone can be a documentarian to some degree. What are your thoughts on the emergence of podcasts and documentaries as drivers of culture and storytelling? And the threat they pose to legacy media, and how important is this phenomenon for the cannabis community?
So first of all, I think it's amazing that everybody is a photographer and a filmmaker now. Like, I, as somebody who appreciates the art, watching it grow into what it did in such a short amount of time is amazing. I think it's awesome seeing so many artists out there leading and driving this new media content. I think the risk of it is we run into everybody can do it, so we all of a sudden don't have a bar of excellence anymore, you know, and I think that's something that we definitely need to still maintain. You know, we need to maintain it. Photography and documentary work is so important, and to be able to tell this story outside of people that are just interested in cannabis, it requires a certain level of professionalism and look to it, you know. But I think with the influencers and stuff, so much of this media now is driven by just pictures of cannabis, drone shots, and all of that, which is all beautiful work. But there's so many stories that need to be told, and I think those are being lost. And I think it's great that we have podcasts like your podcast and other podcasts that are popping up, because we're sharing those stories. And I think that we should contribute more to that kind of storytelling versus just sitting by the pool taking pictures of us while we're in bathing suits or something, you know. Like, that's all good content, but man, there's so many amazing, beautiful stories in this whole movement, and that's where I think our focus should be on going into the future, especially with AI. We're not going to know what is real or not, you know. Here in a couple of years, there's literally going to be no telling if a documentary is even real. So if we, the people who are living these stories, are telling the stories, there's an authenticity to that can't be faked. And I think that transcends subject, and that really speaks to the heart of anybody who's interested in a good story at that point.
I mean, the challenge really seems like how do you stand out from the zone flooding of all of the scroll bait and rage bait and the 120-second tension span stuff, right?
Yeah, you don't stand out. Like, that's the problem, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what it is I think it's like what you're doing. It's like you're cultivating, you're speaking to the people that you know. You know, and it's like, and that's, I think, where we have to start. That's how we stand out, because you're not going to stand out. No matter what you put out, it's algorithm based. You know, the algorithm decides what's out there. It's not even about popularity anymore. So I think it's all about these micro and these niche markets. If you can get in there and speak to people that you know are going to listen to what you're saying, then that will grow. And a good story is a good story. You know, if you start telling it to people, then other people will continue to tell it. And I think that's the only way I can think of how you do it, you know?
Yeah. Nothing's better than a good story told by a good storyteller. What are some of your biggest challenges of photographing photographing or filming cannabis, whether technical, legal, or cultural? I mean, you've been arrested and charged in the course of doing your work. What was all that like?
That was pretty amazing. Amazing is probably not the word for it. More interesting. Like, what happened was I started filming, like I say, in 2003. In 2004, we filmed all of Eddie's field going in the healing fields. That brought the DEA in, which gave Eddie two life sentences. They charged him two life sentences. Myself and my crew got arrested during that time, and the DEA actually came up to us and said, "Who is the film crew?" And then they took us all in, so they knew what we were doing. Then Eddie ended up, this is all through the story, Eddie ended up selling a pound to an undercover agent and got arrested again in that February of 2005. And then the DEA came in again and took 275 hours of my film and arrested me and then put me on the RICO list with Eddie. So I was facing the same charges with him, even though I never really believed that they would go after me that hard. I'm just a filmmaker. But it took us a year to get the footage back. And we got it back because the First and the Fourth Amendment, their search warrants were bunk, you know, and they knew who I was. They came in specifically to take my tapes, as well as get Eddie, but they came in for me specifically for my tapes. So when we got those back, it was amazing. But what was really shocking to me was just at the time, if you're going to capture these tapes and put them in the computer, you need like terabytes of information. We're talking 250 hours of tapes, you know. And at the time, the biggest hard drive is 250 gigabytes. So you cannot do a one-to-one ratio where you're taking tapes and putting them in the computer. And everybody at the time assumed, oh, well, if you shoot a tape, it's in the computer. And I was amazed at how many people were upset at me for not having backups of my tapes and how little people really understood how complicated and expensive that would have been at that time. You know, and that really taught me about how, even though people are like, it's like AI now, even though people would be like, oh, we can just do it in AI, the general person really doesn't understand what that means, you know? And so when we got the tapes back, I was A, elated that I had the footage back, but B, amazed that we got the tapes back. There's so many people I've talked to that the DEA has taken their footage or their stuff and they've never given it back. So I felt like, I don't know, man, it felt like right, you know, when we got them back. So
when they could have said, this is evidence.
Yeah, that's what they tried to do. But, you know, they couldn't do that because they also admitted that I was a filmmaker. But what they tried to do, if you read the court papers, if you read all of that, they tried to position me as a dealer. So they tried to say that I was taking pounds off of Eddie's farm and running them to other states on Greyhound. And I wasn't. I was going to film gigs, and I could prove that I was going to film gigs. So their whole theory fell apart like really fast. But so yeah, man.
And sometimes they know that they don't have a good case, but they just want to harass. They just want to make your life hard, right? They just want to harass you.
Yeah, that's it. 90% of the time.
And they're probably effective at it. Talk more about your current documentary project. You know, you balance showcasing the plant itself with telling the human stories around it, growers, activists, patients, or consumers. And, of course, you know, the subjects we're talking about are kind of all those things. What are you working on right now, and how can people follow your work?
Great questions. What I'm working on, what I'm really focused on now, is the documentary. It's called Emerald Giants, The Legend of Eddie and Linda, and we're putting it together. It's shot. We have footage all the way back to 99. We have footage on Dennis Perone's farm in Lake County. We have Eddie on Dennis Perone's farm in Lake County, which is amazing, right? Because Eddie and Linda tried to shoot themselves at first. So we have those tapes. And so the documentary is basically going to be Eddie's life from 1999 all the way up until when he passed away in 2021. And it's going to be a fly on the wall view of it. You know, we're going to see actually what he went through, and we need to get the final interviews now so we can weave all of that in together. The way I describe it to people is I'm sure you know Eddie, you know Eddie well, so this will make sense, but Eddie is the Tiger King of the cannabis world.
Absolutely. You know? That is the perfect description.
So that's how we're putting it together. We're putting it together. It's like, for me, the plant isn't important, because even if Eddie grew tomatoes, he would still be interesting. You know, like Eddie and Linda themselves are interesting. That's why we start where we start. There's so many people that can tell better stories than I can about why the plant is important. There's scientists out there that can break that down. But what I know is Eddie is amazing. And Eddie, like when we filmed, we weren't just filming, oh, hey, this is fun. Eddie would have post-traumatic stress breakdowns. The day Eddie turned himself into prison, he had a full-on post-traumatic stress breakdown. And I filmed all of it. We were right there. We jump in the car. Eddie was ready to run, and we were right there. It was me and Eddie in the car, and we're driving away, and Eddie stopped. He's like, no, I can't do this, and he's got to go back. And he went back to the house. Like, that's how close we were and how much Eddie let us film. So when you watch this, you're not going to be watching, oh, hey, this is great. Pot is good. You're going to be seeing people go through cancer. You're going to be seeing them in the doctor's office when they hear the news that cancer's not going away. We have Linda 10 minutes after she found out she has a month to live. We have an interview with her. So it is real, real, you know, and that's the gift that Eddie gave us, is Eddie let us in there and let us film the most personal and real moments that you could imagine, that you could ever imagine. And who does that? You know, like, I could never let anybody do that, you know. So that is really what the film is about, is not just about, hey, cannabis, but it's about what people have to go through for their beliefs and how far people would go for love. This whole thing that Eddie did, his whole field, and he even said this at the Seattle Hemp Fest on stage, it's all because Linda got cancer and he wanted to save his wife. And that led to an entire revolution for him.
Wow.
Yeah. And so to follow my work, we have a website called emeraldgiants.com, and you can find us on Instagram, Emerald Giants Official. And yeah, we're just going to start putting more out. We have a 24-minute piece now. It's called an exclusive sneak peek, and we're taking that out. We're doing parties. We did a great party at the Chapel of Flowers in Berkeley. They're attached to CBCB, really great club. Shout-outs to Andrea for helping us out with that. We're going to be doing another party there soon, and we're just going to show the film, do a question and answer. We have people like Lynette Shaw and leftover people from 215 to, you know, to show the younger generation how we got to where we're at.
You know, Jason, my thoughts on what you're doing, the cannabis culture is like a parallel universe. I mean, these people are like legends, you know, like bigger than life, icons in the cannabis culture, and kind of unknown to anybody else, you know, to the mainstream. I mean, even me, you know, I'm nobody. And I went to the Cannabis Cup in Amsterdam, and there's all these people that knew who I was, people from other countries. I was completely stunned. They knew my name. They knew about HempFest and stuff. And what you are doing is exposing this world to the world, to the rest of the world, right? To this kind of sub world, this sub reality to the mainstream public. What are your thoughts on that?
No, that's exactly the goal. What happened in a nutshell was I read a book called The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test years ago.
Tom
Wolfe. And within the first paragraph, opens up this was before I was a filmmaker. This is when I dreamt about doing what I'm doing. And the first paragraph or the first chapter opens up with them going to pick up Ken Kesey from jail. And by the end of the first paragraph, I was like, I need to find a Ken Kesey. I need something like that. And then 2 years later, I'm standing on Eddie's farm. You know, and that's exactly how I look at it. What we're trying to do with the film is we're trying to get it to HBO. It's at UTA, the United Talent Agency Artist, and they're sending it out to different producers because we're trying to get it on HBO or Netflix or something big specifically so we can show this world just like Ken Kesey did, you know, just like Thomas Wolfe did, just like Jack Kerouac did. We want to show the world this subculture that is literally changing the world, like, you know, the Seattle Hemp Fest. You guys changed the world by doing the Seattle Hemp Fest. Change the world. There's no doubt about that. If you remove the Seattle Hemp Fest out of the zeitgeist, the world would not be how it is, you know. And same thing with Eddie and Jack and all these people. And I think the world needs to know why we're here, you know, and who brought us here. That's why it's called Emerald Giants, because I was just going to say it's called Emerald Giants because I've seen the most amazing things by standing on the shoulders of giants.
And it's the most American story. You're talking about the dedication, the absolute dedicating people, so many community activists dedicating their lives They're waking hours, living, breathing, defending cannabis against prohibition, you know?
Yeah. And it's beyond cannabis too, because it's like when you look at some of these guys in Northern California, some of these people in Northern California, it was the logging industry disappeared. So in the 70s and 80s, they slid into cannabis. So you're talking three or four generations deep of American farmers. I mean, yeah. This is like we're an agrarian society. It's not even just about cannabis. It's about these are the American farmers standing on their land telling the government, I'm going to do what I need to do. I mean, it doesn't get more American than that.
And if
at
you
all.
Dive deep into industrial hemp, it's about saving the biosphere. It's about 100%. Saving humanity. 100%. I mean, that's something that people are going to be like, go, what? Right. But then you could spend like, I don't know, a week explaining all the ways that industrial hemp can help mitigate climate change alone. Right. You know, I have to mention, you mentioned the electric chelated acid test, which of course is Tom Wolfe's 1968 book, I think, on Ken Keyes and the Merry Pranksters going across the country in 1966 with acid tests, right, on their psychedelic bus. The further I've actually had Carolyn Mountain Garcia, Jerry Garcia's first wife, George Walker, and Zane Kesey on this show, actually.
Oh, that's amazing.
And of course, you know, Mountain Girl Garcia and George Walker were actual married pranksters on the bus. And Zane Kesey is Ken Kesey's son.
Yeah, yeah. He did a movie about the bus again. Like they did a documentary where they got a new bus and repainted it.
Yes. Yeah. And that bus used to come to Hemp Fest. It was actually at Seattle Hemp Fest every year for about, I don't know, 10, 12 years. Yeah. I mean, this is counterculture. Lore, right? Toke lore, as I like to call it.
100%.
A word that I came up with. You know, your visual style feels distinct. What influences outside of cannabis culture have shaped the way that you shoot and tell your stories?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I love films. Ever since I was a child, since I was 5 years old, I fell in love with the movie The Bride of Frankenstein. And what happened was my sister brought me home a kid's book about the making of Frankenstein. And then I saw The Bride of Frankenstein and I was disappointed that you couldn't see the cameras and the makeup and all of that, you know. So I just fell in love with cinema. And I've always I was third grade when the making of Michael Jackson's Thriller came out, you know, I'm of the generation of blockbuster films, Goonies, E.T., Jaws, Superman, Batman, you know, so I grew up just idolizing filmmakers more than sports. All my friends love sportsmakers. I loved actors and filmmakers. That's what it was. So I've always studied photography like that. And then there's a Bob Dylan documentary I saw called Don't Look Back. And I saw that right as I started filming Eddie's. And I was just like, this is everything to me, you know? So like a lot of my style comes directly out of that old horror film, you know, that classic photography style that I love, high contrasty black and whites and stuff. And then for documentaries, it's like, you know, when you watch those old Orson Welles films and you look at those cinematographers, they're so good at storytelling with their lenses. You could take all the words out of it, you know, and it's like that's what really draws me is how would Orson Welles do this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Orson Welles was just a master, a genius ahead of his time. When you start a new cannabis related project, what's your process for developing the concept and I guess the visual language that you use? How do you start? How do you map things out?
Well, I start with low hanging fruit. Like what's the closest thing around? Who do I know that has a great story? You know, and then so like with the Lynette story, for example, like Lynette Shaw has one of the most amazing stories in cannabis. You know, there's not a lot of people left over from 215. And so their stories are beautiful. And but with Lynette, she doesn't have anything left over from that time. She was busy living her life, not photographing it and recording it. You know, luckily with Eddie's, I was there to film everything. That's the only reason we have a story. So when it comes to Lynette, I look at Lynette and I'm like, OK, how can I get this story out? And the thing that just makes the most sense is Lynette is amazing when she just sits down and talks to her friends. So I'm like, how do we get that? How do we make it so somebody can just listen to her conversations? And then podcast makes sense. And so you just keep breaking it down like that until what's the easiest way and the most effective way to get this story out for people to hear it, you know? and everything becomes utilitarian at that point. And then from there, you just put on whatever style you want to put on, whatever you're feeling in the moment, you know?
You know, you mentioned the legacy 215 people, and you know, I'm way pre 215, right? And you also kind of touched on the fact that there are these communities like in Northern California, maybe even in Oregon, that were there for 30 years. These are people that were, you know, back to the landers, Vietnam vets, hippies, you know, trying to get out of the city, who you know, settled in Northern California, kind of, you know, homesteading, and discovered real quickly that they could grow pot and trade it for things they needed that they couldn't grow, right? They couldn't produce, like sugar and coffee and what have you. And it didn't take long before this giant economy, this kind of sub-economy developed. And you had, you know, everybody benefited from it. I mean, car dealers, people selling, you know, dishwashers, right? And it actually rose the standard of living for everybody in these communities. And a lot of these people thought, you know, I'm going to hang in there. I'm going to keep doing this. And someday I'm going to be able to go legit. Someday we're going to legalize it. And I'm going to be able to do this legitimately. And most of those people I've been watching, especially the last 5-10 years, have been pushed out and they can't compete. Yeah. You know, they can't compete with the carpet bagging kind of corporate element, the kind of big agro approach that some people do, and the regulations and the changing, you know, rules and stuff being meted out, and the high tax brackets. You've kind of seen that. What are your thoughts on all that?
That's the current state of everything right now. I mean, not just cannabis. That's the state of everything. You know. Oh man, like just in the film industry alone, like I'm not bagging on AI at all. I'm actually building an AI editing assistant on my computer today after we're done with this. So AI is a very strong tool, but I'm telling you right now, it's knocked out about 25% of Hollywood, and it's going to be even worse. It's just getting started. When you look at farms in the Midwest, they're using drones with lasers on them to shoot weeds. Like the amount of technology they're pouring into this is crazy. And what I think is, I think it's going to get, this is going to sound cynical, but I think it's going to get worse, because as soon as they federally legalize it or reschedule it, we're going to see trillions of dollars roll into this economy, into this business. You're going to see the big corporations come in. And so what I personally think, and I don't know if I'm wrong about this, but what I personally think is there's all these growers up in Northern California right now that are focused on creating boutique strains and buying farms and from old vineyards and stuff like that. I think it's going to be like the wine industry. I think you're going to have your boutique strains, and then I think you're just going to have a bunch of corporate cannabis. What I'm hoping is that they'll let people still grow their own pot. You know, I'm hoping that it's not like alcohol where it's like, you get caught moonshining, you're screwed. You know, I'm hoping
we can't grow our own pot here. If you're not a patient and not
really
registered. Yeah. We have no home grow. You know, me and most of my friends.
Are you in Washington?
Yeah, most of my friends voted against I-502 because of the DUI provision that was a 5-nanogram unscientific DUI thing.
If you got caught smoking, or if you were driving, they could do a test on you, and it was under a 0.5?
If you're over 0.05 nanograms, then you get a DUI.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and it wasn't scientific. And the no home grow, man, we still have no home grow. And, you know, it was the most conflicted I've ever been on anything. We're running out of time. We got a little, we got about a minute and a half. Real quickly, what do you want your role? What role do you want your work to play in the evolution of filmmaking and cannabis? And what final thoughts would you like to share with us while we still have a couple minutes?
That's a big question. I guess for me, I'm just a storyteller. You know, I'm a vessel. I hear people's stories and I pass them through. And I really hope and I really believe, not hope, I believe that Eddie and Linda's story, Eddie Lepp and Linda Sentai's story, is a universal story that will shine light on what people have to go through in this industry. And not just in this industry, in this country and in this world. You know, we have we have a beautiful story, a beautiful story. And I really feel like it's going to help people. I feel like it's going to, it's more than entertainment. It's education, you know, and I really, really hope that it inspires people to tell their own stories. That's my main goal. I hope that as a filmmaker, that other people will become filmmakers because they can look at my work and go, if that schmuck can do it, then I can do it. that's what Jason, I hope.
Jason, telling stories is what we're about here at Hemp Presents. And thank you so much for taking the time out to tell yours. And I saw your teaser and it's stunning. It was the most gripping. It was the most gripping thing I've ever seen around prohibition. We got to wrap it up. So good luck on your endeavors, my friend.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me on the show. It's fantastic seeing you again, man.
Absolutely. The Hemp Presents intro music is 7 Mile Beach by Joanne Rand. And the outro music, Take Back the Plant by those crazy guys, Sticker Bush. See you next time and stay strong. Marijuana, THC, sweet sativa.
Give the gift that everyone wants, Omaha Steaks. Right now, save 50% site-wide, plus get an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. Save on USDA-certified tender bacon-wrapped filet mignons, perfectly aged ribeyes, gourmet sides, and decadent desserts delivered right to their door. Skip the stress. Order now at omahasteaks.com. That's omahasteaks.com, and use code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout to get an extra $35 off. Hurry, these deals won't last. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details.
How much money do you lose every time you miss a customer call? With a Buzz CRM, you never have to worry about that again. Their system automatically texts missed calls and engages leads instantly using conversational AI. It turns your missed opportunities into booked appointments automatically. It's a complete game changer for local businesses. Secure your access today for a massive discount at thebuzzcrm.com. That's thebuzzcrm.com.